All right, so if you're in this room, we're going to make some assumptions that you are at least somewhat clear as to who you do your best work for, how you do it, and what that ongoing service model looks like, right? We talked yesterday in this room about just kind of crafting that service model and how the narrower that audience becomes, the easier, relatively speaking, it can be to create that service model. What we want to do now is, in this conversation, kind of back the train up a little bit and start at the top of how do you promote, position, and prospect yourself within your niche. So Don and I are going to talk through our respective journeys, what is working well for us. Our intention is to spend 30 minutes to go through our lesson, go through the content that we have here today. Then we will open it up for Q&A, and then that will give you, that will kind of lead into your work time to start formulating some ideas. There we go. Formulating some ideas, your next best step. I'm a really, really big fan of those three words. What's your next best step that you're going to take? Like we said, we've talked a lot about overwhelm and about 80,000 different ideas that you're going to come away from this, from our time here over these past couple of days. What are you solving for, and what's your next best step in that process? So the biggest thing that is hard to comprehend, not really hard to comprehend, it can be sometimes hard to accept, is that going into a niche and becoming that resident expert where people are now being attracted to you instead of you pursuing them is the long game. There's a book out there called The Long Tail, which just kind of talks about the long tail of any event that you do or any process inevitably can pay the biggest dividends, but it's not the sizzle in the pan. This is not going to be an all sizzle, no steak presentation. We want to emphasize that it is a long runway to get to that point of developing that expertise. I can say on the other end of that, it's a glorious position to be in when you are the resident expert and you're having to manage for capacity. How do you really market to your niche? There are a lot of different ways in which you can market to your niche, right? Kitsis has done some work on, you know, 5 or 6 different types of niche marketing that you can do. I am obviously a big proponent for profession-based niche marketing. For me, what I've observed in profession-based niche marketing is that it helps from an efficiency standpoint for me to not only be really effective and efficient in attracting people to our firm, but on the back end of that, from a service standpoint, it allows us to be really, really efficient in crafting our service model, our deliverables, our value adds. Contrasting that, one of the other niches that I could pursue if I wanted to, everybody knows I love general aviation, love being a pilot. I could do, as Ron Carson did, passion prospecting, right? Ron loves Nebraska football, pilots, or aviation, and wine. And that's what he did, a lot of passion prospecting. My contention with that is it's not impossible, because obviously Ron did something pretty darn well building the firm that he built. But on the service side of things, it can be a little bit more, you got to be a little bit more strategic in that, because now you could potentially have a client base master of the ones, right? They all have a common denominator of sharing whatever passion it is that you have, but you might have a pilot that's a business owner. You might have a pilot that's an engineer. You might have another one that's a real estate mogul. Like, there's all kinds of different things. So how do you craft that service model? That's just something to be cognizant of as you're not necessarily defining your niche, but thinking about how you're going to market to that niche. Referrals with COIs, personal interest, again, multiple different ways in which you can build and craft and market towards your niche. Don has really done a great job of perfecting and narrowing down who he does his work for, which is a little bit different than ours. Don, you want to share a little bit about what you've done?
Yeah. First off, you're so intimidating because you're so polished. And I feel like I'm always nervous. So if you see me shaking, that's deliberate.
We're all friends here, my friend.
All right. So that said, love you guys. Thank you. So maybe like 36 months ago, I was hearing Adam speak and so forth, and hopefully like all of you, this felt or feels like a fire hose of information. So I chose one, if not two things to really focus on, and made it a point to say, okay, when the head trash comes, I'll do my meditation and I'll make it a point to get really good at two things. It was surge and it was niche, maybe in that order. And I felt that my niche is an expression of who I am. And that's what kept me motivated, because this stuff is hard. For me, at least, this stuff is really hard. So again, when I look at my mentor or mentors, Adam, very polished. Nice. You see me, right? Like,
I love the Jordans. I mean,
thank you.
Kudos to Don. I have not gotten shout outs in chat in the virtual about my shoe game. Don has gotten multiple different comments on his Jordan shoe game. So my two boots are not anything compared to your Jordan. So
well, and then this is actually deliberate too, because I used to wear blazers. In fact, I knew Adam was going to show up all polished and stuff, and I mean that's a compliment. I tried wearing my blazers. I used to be a triathlete, Ironman, and so forth. They don't fit me anymore. Plus, COVID wasn't friendly to me, so I'm 30 pounds over. But here's the thing. When I go to Google, this is how we dress. I used to be the one wearing a suit, and you know what they said to me for 4 years? Done. So you were that guy who always got the interviews, but we never hired you. Because I'm always in the suit. And I don't know how it is for the rest of you, but smart casual is so hard to dress. I don't know how to do it. So you saw me wearing glasses? That didn't work very well. I got a headache in the middle of the day. So I'm glad you get my humor. That's all I do when I talk to my Googlers. I'm not trying to say, yeah, hire me. I know about standard deviation. Or Don, you know what? We like you because you really do a good Monte Carlo. No. It's really about, for me, bringing the human element. And you can see here, you know, for compliance reasons, compliance. Can't really show the pictures, but I show up. If a client or a Googler says, Don, we planted a tree. How far do you live? I want to be there. Because when that tree grows, we're going to use that as an analogy to how we grow your money. Right? So there, I don't know if you see that there, right? So look, I'm shaking. Can't fake this. Super nervous. Hold on.
Breath.
Okay. So the way I committed to my niche was, okay, who are the people I want to work with? It didn't necessarily mean working at Google. It's just I work with people who happen to be highly compensated, who happen to be high good savers like me, and who happen to work in big tech. So I just see it as every day I get to work with people just like me. So the authentic self shows, hence I'm able to build my practice.
When you think back to the decision-making matrix that you went through and kind of made that commitment to effectively burn the ships and only, maybe not only, but put a very, very big emphasis on working with Googlers, what was that catalyst? Is there something that came to mind on why you enjoyed working with them? Was it that you just liked RSUs and equity compensation? Did you have family that worked at Google? What was your affinity and attraction to Google?
I love that question. So
that's why I asked it.
When I first started, I was a fan of Google during my broker-dealer days. I worked for UBS back in the day. And at the time, I was 25 years old. Google was 4 years since its IPO. So it was everything big tech to me. It was young, it was disruptive. I felt that way, because at the time you had Intel, you had Microsoft already established. Google was exciting. So my first Googler, I call him or her Agent Zero. And I remember getting a COI call. And all I remember was, Don, I have this high level program engineer at Google. They need help. And I was all in. I didn't know how to quantify them. I didn't know what their assets were. But the idea of showing up at the Google office to walk like this in the office, like, it's amazing, right? I was a fan. So the fact that I was able to show up, it didn't feel like work. I felt like my first question till this day is, what's it like working at Google? It's so awesome, because I can go into my spiel, talk about, you know, finance, but I want to hear about you. Tell me about you, you know, vocal vomit to me, and I will do my best to align it to financial decisions. But at the end of the day, we will have a tremendous experience, because I'm here to learn.
Abbreviated before and after, where were you when you started, and okay. how was that, what was that impact, and what was the timeline, right? Because back to that first slide, the frustration that advisors can sometimes feel is, Adam, I just need more clients. If I just had more prospects, if I just had more clients, then all of my worries would just fall away and I'd be the happiest advisor in the world. Different conversation about that, right? Because that's not what happens, because there you're just amplifying a problem if you don't have systems in place. Different conversation. But my point there is, we say it is a year plus two, sometimes even 3 year runway, depending on what modality you're going to pursue your market. I'll talk a little bit about mine. What was that timeline look like, and what was the impact that you had and what you're experiencing now?
Okay, so before Limitless, I was just over 200 gross, solo practitioner. 6 months into Limitless, Surge and Niche, I went to 300 in 6 months. I didn't even know. Stephanie had to say, wow, Don, look at this. And I thought, wow, this haven't even felt like I tried. So long story short, within 24 months, I doubled my income, but I was working less because I was tackling my niche. I knew what their pain points were, and I was just enjoying my work. I got lost in my work. The numbers took care of itself. And my philosophy is, the money will be there as long as I prioritize helping others. That's what keeps me going. That's what keeps away the head trash.
Well, and the reason that I asked that question and wanted Don to share his experience in the growth trajectory that he experienced is that we're all here, let's call a spade, we're all here to grow bigger businesses in less time. That's the unicorn equation, that's the unicorn variable that we're looking to create here. The idea of niche marketing and going where the fish are is akin to firing with a rifle instead of a shotgun, right? With a shotgun approach, we can do the spray and pray method. We can just go in there guns blazing and do shredded parties and do JP Morgan market analysis updates. And we can do, let me talk to you about Roth conversions, right? But that's the generic way of doing it, which is more of a spray and pray and a, let me see if I can pull this slot machine lever and just by happenstance, run a couple of triple sevens or whatever, berries or whatever. I'm not a slot player or gambler for that matter. I'll just stop with that metaphor. Or you can take that sniper rifle approach, go fishing where the fish are, whatever metaphor that you want to use to realize that at the narrower that you take your message, and this was the epiphany and the interesting paradox that I experienced going through this. I started out with white coats, right? It was optometrists, dentists, pharmacists, and physicians. I had a little bit of a niche. And even in those four, I had sub niches. With pharmacists, I specifically worked with CVS pharmacists at the PIC level and above, pharmacists in charge. The reason for that is because pharmacists in charge on up were qualified or were part of their compensation, part of their bonus that was paid out in every March was through non-qualified stock options, which then transitioned to RSUs. And I enjoyed learning about that. I had CVS's SPD memorized and I would do dinners with CVS. And one of my biggest rainmakers at that time is still one of my great clients, one of the 20 clients that I held on to as I transitioned my book over to John. But then I get this invitation to go to a dentistry event. Ooh, shiny object. And I would go do the IDDS, the Indianapolis District Dental Society. And I'd go do their fair and their golf outing. And I'd start shaking hands and write columns for them and look at dental economics. Guess what happened to my momentum in the pharmacy space? And then I get invited to go speak at Franciscan St. Francis or whatever the hospital organization is in Indianapolis. Hey, can you come talk to some residents? Sure, squirrel, right? I'll go ahead and do that. Guess what happened to my momentum with IDDS? So my point with that, the narrower that I took my message and as I crafted who my ideal avatar was, the easier it became to create a message and create content. And as you get narrower with that message and just hone in with that sniper rifle, every shot that you fire, ready, fire, aim, right? We're here to get ready today. I want to make sure that you have enough information for your next best step to fire that first shot and see where it lands and then recalibrate, reevaluate, and reengage. That's the goal of niche marketing, to get that message as narrow as possible, where now my message, the content that I'm creating is largely based for optometric private practice owners that have either owned their practice for at least 5 years and are doing $1 million in top line revenue, or they're within 5 years of selling their practice. Ideally, I will work with them in negotiating a sale to a private equity firm. We'll work with other ODs, other OD practice owners. And I actually have a referral relationship with another advisor out there that also works with optometrists, but he doesn't want to work with practice owners. Both his parents are optometrists, they own their practice, and he's ironically enough, really doesn't want to work with practice owners. He just likes working with associates. He likes working through student loan analysis. I'm like, sweet, I finally have someone else that knows optometry that I can send my non-ideal prospects. So I'm a rainmaker for him. I want to talk about that. The message that we want to share here today is the narrower that you can take that message, the easier all of those dominoes that we stack up for you in Limitless, the easier those dominoes are to knock down. Hold that thought, Virgil. I want to make sure that we get through content and then we'll go ahead through Q&A. So again, are you speaking to someone or everyone? Get that message tightened up. And when you're writing your content, when you're doing video, if you're doing a podcast, if you're doing COI, whatever it is that you're going to be doing, always think about asking yourself, who am I talking with? If I'm reading this content, think qualitatively, values, qualities, personality, and quantitatively, what would this person bring to the table? Is this who I want to hear my message? And do the math. This was an epiphany that I had 2018 when I effectively burned bridges and went all in on optometry. People will say, I still About once a week, we get an email from an advisor that wants to bend my ear and schedule a time to talk with me. And we've scripted out this whole email that Kathy will just send off to them with a link to resources and Kitsis interviews and things like that. But the point in that is when they find out, one of the reasons that they reach out is like, I can't believe you only work with optometrists. Like, what do you do with all the other people that your referrals and people that reach out that aren't optometrists? And I just sit back and laugh because A, no one else that's not an optometrist is reaching out, because when you go to our website, you know, in 1.5 seconds or however long it takes you to read five words, helping optometrists plan life on purpose, six words, whatever. That you're not, I'm repelling 99.996% of the general population, I think is what the math comes out to be. There's 11,000 private practice owners in the country, optometry private practice owners. There's 35,000, give or take, depending on how you're measuring it and graduating classes and things like that, 35,000-ish optometrists. My number for my practice, the next iteration of my business plan, is two advisors, 200 households, 2.5 million in revenue. That's the numbers that we've crunched. So do I think that with the trifecta of inbound content that I'm creating, the speaking that I'm doing nationally, the writing that I'm doing for national publications, and 2020 money, those are the three general drivers of inbound relationships that are reaching out to our firm. Do I think that I can attract 200 households out of 11,000 private practice owners? I'm a blue ocean mentality kind of guy. Yeah, I'm pretty sure I can. So whatever niche that you're thinking about, however you're doing that, right? If I wanted to do passion prospecting and work with pilots, great. I can go to the FAA database and I can pull the fact that there are I don't even know what the number is. I can find how many private pilots are out there, and I can search by certification and ratings and things like that. Whatever your ideal avatar is, whatever that common denominator that they have, if you're having some of those limiting beliefs of, oh, I can't say no to 99% of people. They brought $2 million, but they're not my niche. I guess I'll say yes to them. Oops, scarcity, you know, basket in the desert. I better take it now because I don't know when the next one's going to come along. Do the math on however you're qualifying those prospects as best you can. And that for me is what helped basically put out that fire that started in my mind whenever I got the scarcity. Like, I'm only going to work with optometrists. How many Googlers are there?
Over 100,000.
Think Don's going to be okay. How many do you need to build your ideal practice?
6 to 8 per year.
Ball game. Right? Don't overcomplicate it. Anything that you did?
Yeah, you're like my idol. Like the way,
shut up, geez.
The way, what benefit do I get lying, right? Like the way he's framing it, I'm thinking, why am I standing next to him? Like, this is like totally like, so this is a good
friend. Can you pass me my coffee, please? Cause I'm dying for a absolutely. Sip right now. Okay. Thank you, sir. I don't mean to step in front.
The secret sauce, check water. Yeah. Okay, so great segue for me. Don't overcomplicate it. When I hear Adam, it's like, I mean this as a compliment, turn headlights. I'm like, oh my gosh, I do not know my business like that, but your vision is different. It's crafted for you. Me, you don't notice how he asked me how many clients do I need or Googlers? 6 to 8, no problem. So what great marketing. There's a Google conference right now.
That was hilarious. Right? Did you see the sign?
Yeah, that was intended. Yeah. So normally, if I want to use the shotgun analogy, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to go, hey guys, what's up, friend? I work at Google, kind of. What's going on? No. Because I don't work necessarily with all Googlers. 90% at least of my Googlers are women. I don't know why, but that's the case. Maybe 80% are site reliability engineers. The fun ones for me, the ones that I do enjoy them. Exactly, site reliability engineers. Their job is to keep the Google screen, when you search, white. Because there's all this. Yeah, see, I know this stuff. Because
how many
the lingo.
People does it take to do that? I'm sorry. I'm very sarcastic in that, but it demonstrates I don't know jack about that. And that's okay because he does.
So here's my rare moments of poise. Because again, super anxious. I do not feel compelled to go in that room and like just throw my business cards like you're paying me for them. Because I know my niche. It's, you know, I saw that room. I took a glance. Where's Christian? Christian. So he called my bluff. I said, Christian, let's cold walk this room right now, buddy. And he said, yeah. I'm like, crap, I was kidding. Because I already knew that when I saw the room, 9 out of 10 people are men. That's not my niche. I can't do it. I don't have the gall to do it.
Man, I know my numbers. I just heard a lot of limiting beliefs there, didn't I?
Yeah, so I am just like my peers. And when you tell me, hey, can I get 6 to 8 Googlers per year? I think so. Because without knowing, my first year at Limitless, I got, I think, like 16 to 18. And I said no twice. So the
out of the 16 process, 18, what did you learn?
Keep it so simple.
Did you have mistakes in those 16 to 18?
Oh, so many. I'm a big fan of videos, Loom. I challenge anyone to do a one-page plan better than me. I will own that space. Because that's I'm saying it right now. Okay, so my I have a YouTube channel in my website. Click on it. Yeah, I'm not marketing my YouTube, but the idea is this. I'm comfortable being anxious and insecure in most things, but I know I'm confident in the things that matter for myself and my clients. So when I can present, when I can immediately engage my client or clients to show them, here's where you are, here's where you're headed. The response is, Don, can you come on campus to show this to our team? Because we have a whole inventory of advisors, but what you're talking about makes sense. Yeah, I'm there. Show me. That's how we do it.
Well, and this is the point, right? Whether it's the number of optometric private practice owners, the number of Googlers. I mean, Don could even, if he wanted to, you could probably refine your niche, and you already have. I know you already have, but there's probably a couple more iterations of how targeted your message could be. Of I only work with Googlers in this department, or I only work with Googlers. One of friends of mine who's Michael Policar is an advisor out in Washington. And having a conversation with him a couple of years ago from a niching standpoint, he was kind of having some of the reservations that I think a lot of you in the room might have of, who am I to do this? Can I make this leap? What is that going to look like? Is the opportunity really there? And we worked through this. And now, at least at that time, and I know he's gone through some reiterations of that, his ideal avatar, his ideal prospect was a Costco employee where more than 50% of their compensation was through equity grants. Like niche weird. Like to quote Dennis Mosley Williams in one of my favorite Kitsis interviews, that'll give you ADHD if you don't already have it. Listen to Dennis talk. He's great. He's brilliant in what he does. But man, that guy brings a lot of energy to a conversation. But that idea of refining down your message and refining down the numbers of what you need, not only to build the practice that you want, but then to take that and contrast that to the number of opportunities out there. How many people are playing in the sandbox that you're creating or that you are already going to play in, right? I created the sandbox of 2020 Money, the podcast that we launched. We're at 173 episodes now, the most consistent thing that I've ever done in my life, which I will tell you the secret to that is knowing that my producer is waiting for an episode every single week. If you want to be successful in podcasting, at least for me, the worst thing that you can do is absorb that responsibility all by yourself for two reasons. Number one, don't do that. It's not your unique skill set. Even if you enjoy doing that, I'll have advisors say, oh, Adam, I like editing. It's fun. I get to hear myself. Listen to the finished episode. I do. Not all. I listen to about 50% of my own episodes, which some might say narcissistic. No, I want to learn. I want to learn, how am I asking questions? What are the questions that I'm asking? Am I talking too much? Am I talking too little? One of my biggest pet peeves in interviews with podcasting, two things, not to deviate too much here, but I know that there are those in the room here that are either interested in podcasting or have started. My biggest pet peeve in podcast interviews is when the host continues to interrupt the guest that's giving an answer. Even if it's just, shut up. Just let your guest answer. The second thing that drives me nuts in podcasts is when the host basically reiterates in their own words what the guest just said. I was there too. I heard it. I don't need you to reframe it. Anyway, not to digress here, but my point is I chose to create a podcast, 2020 Money, not the year 2020, right? 20/20. Anybody that's gotten an eye exam, some of them from Boston. Anybody that has gotten an eye exam knows that best corrected acuity ideally is 2020. Some can get down to 2015. That resonates with my audience. And I created this sandbox of 2020 Money. For the first 3 years of the podcast, it took us 3 years to get to 100,000 downloads of the podcast. In the last 3 months, we're now at 120,000 downloads. So how many of us have seen from a content creation standpoint, this kind of goes back to that long tail play, right? That hockey stick type growth. I feel like 2020 Money is just getting that at that inflection point where our downloads are going to continue to go up. And that is one of the three-pronged approach that we have to attract our ideal type of client. And the message that we're creating is continually refined down. So to this third point here, right? Do same stuff as before, but focus that message down. If you're blogging and you've done that, great. Focus that message down. My people know that I'm, if you don't know already, I'll say it now. I am ruthless about delegation and getting things off your plate. If you're writing your own blog post right now, I would challenge you to think, is that something that I can outsource? Short answer, yes. You can script that out. You can do, I do a Loom video for my content creator. We just brought on a new one that's gonna be basically turning 2020 money into a couple of eBooks, or excuse me, they're gonna be taking the top most popular episodes of 2020 money, turning those into long form blog posts. Those long form blog posts are then going to be packaged up into a couple of eBooks. Eventually that eBook will then be published in a book. That's probably gonna be sometime in 2023. So whatever sandbox that you're either going to create or that you're going to play in, know the problems that your niche is facing, right? Back to what Carl said yesterday, people don't care about our solutions, they care about their problems. The more surgical that you can be with what keeps them up at night, what concerns them, what challenges are they facing, what opportunities do they have? How do I manage the tax liability for my RSUs that get granted? When, I mean, I don't even pretend to know if that's even a thing in Google, if it's non-qualified or ISOs or, but those are questions that they have that he's better positioned than 99% of the other advisors in the country to go ahead and answer like that. Which also, one thing I'll say before we kind of move on here is one of the imposter syndrome / limiting beliefs that can creep up as you become surgical and become the expert in your niche is that you will get really, really efficient in answering questions that your niche has, which if you're like me, can sometimes be a crisis of confidence to say, it only took me 30 minutes to do this financial plan and you're gonna pay me $15,000. What? Yeah, because we're that good. So don't equate the amount of money that you can make and the amount of money that you can charge, and we're gonna talk about that in a fee lesson later today. Don't equate the amount that you're going to charge to the time that you're gonna invest with that client. The ideal situation is that the better that you get in serving your niche, the easier it is to serve them, the quicker, not cheaper, but the quicker you can serve them, you can have more impact with more people and actually work less from a time standpoint. Working less and delivering value are not correlated variables. Does that make sense? That's what I had a point when I got, I still remember, I think this was last year in Limitless, I did a financial plan for a client on a dry erase board. Right, one of our optometry clients, and this was when I had just raised fees. Right now, our fee schedule for practice owners is a $2,500 onboarding fee. It's an annual fee paid in two ways, a $2,500 onboarding fee and then $695 per month. So just kind of on autopilot on the 15th of every month. And this is one of our newer clients that we had just brought on at that a little bit higher fee schedule. We had done $595, then we did $695, and I did their financial plan on a whiteboard, just drawing arrows and moving money around. And they're like, this is great, this is awesome. And you know, had the poker face on, thanks, yeah, blah, 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 you know, we'll be in touch with next steps. And I finished the meeting and then I'm like, did that really just happen? I did a Loom video for Stephanie and I think they posted it in Tribe last year. It's like, this client just paid us $11,000 and we picked up like 600,000 that they had sitting in their practice and we charged separately for AUM as well. So we had a really, really good day, so to speak, with this new client. And it took me 45 minutes in a whiteboard. That was a limiting, that was a breakthrough that I had to get through mentally to be comfortable with the value that I delivered and how quickly, relatively speaking, I was able to deliver. Because previously I had been a master of the ones, right? Had clients all over the place. And then I'd have to learn a new SPD and have to learn this and have to learn this. And if, as you know your niche and as you know the questions that they have, which is why we talk about here, do your homework, know their language, change the conversation. Our intro call is not an intro call, it's a triage call, right? Our data collection form is an intake form. Speak their language, connect with them. And as I did that, I started to realize that we were much more efficient in our ability to deliver value, which had not only a positive impact on their life, it has a positive impact on my P&L, as well as on my quality of life. I can't think of a better win-win-win situation. Again, we talked about know your numbers here. Anything that we would add to this, Don? Like, we kind of talked about it a little bit before, but
No, I think you covered it.
Okay. Well, I want to make sure that we're, yep, got like 2 minutes here. Oh yeah, this is always my favorite one, looking at the websites of advisors. The generic, it's either a white couple strolling on a beach, a lighthouse, or a compass. I mean, come on. And even mine, I mean, we're going through a reiteration on our website as well, but we've got the glasses on the homepage. At least there's a little bit of a message there. You've done something a little bit different in the sense that your page isn't completely dedicated to Google. Is that correct? Or am I overstating?
No, it's big tech. But if I can talk about it on my next slide, if Adam's done.
Yep.
All right. So Snappy Kraken, anyone know Snappy Kraken? All right. So their niche is genuine content and so forth. And then I had a one-on-one with them and I said, hey, okay, I work with big tech. Can you customize that? And yeah, Don, I was looking on your website. Didn't really feel tech to me. Oh, really? Okay, this is the Geary Building. That's the biggest office in Venice Beach, 40 minutes away from me. They didn't know that because they're not Googlers. But who's gonna recognize this? I'm not designing it for everybody. I'm designing it for Googlers. On, you can't see it here, but on the bottom right, it's schedule time with me in the same icon of the internal memorandums at Google when they ping each other, when they do syncs. Syncs are reviews, pinging is texting. I learned the vernacular. So the idea is when I get Googlers who go to my website, their response is, hey, Don, thanks for making it easy. It resonates. And this is a static screen. If you go to my live website, I stream three pictures. This, I mentioned before, 90% of my niche are women. So I have a women engineer running on the whiteboard.
That's that formula, right?
That's correct.
The algorithm, excuse me?
Yes, yeah. Yes, the algorithm that keeps Google white, right? And then a popular hangout in Venice where Googlers go. And all I do before happy hour is just I hang out. Maybe I listen to podcasts, including yours, Adam. And then I'll meet my people, my Googlers. And I'll say, you know, what do you think about the stock split? It's happening in June. Hey, Don, will it affect me? No, because Google doesn't pay a dividend. What's a dividend? Oh, why don't you schedule a meeting with me and we'll talk about it? It's just common language.
So that's Don's, right? Ours is much more right there in your face about in a different way. And even this is something that we're going to be changing, helping optometric practice owners plan life on purpose. The thing that I would point out about our website, and I don't want to turn this too much into a marketing website design, conversion is a really important thing in your web. So what is the next best step, right? Talk about that here with you. I want you to think about the visitors to your website as well. What is the next best step? What's the CTA, the call to action that you want a visitor that sees this website and says, oh, I'm in the right place. Now what? Our goal is to have them start here, right? We've got that start here button. Taylor Schulte kind of created that path for a lot of advisors. I did it. I know a lot of others. I mean, Don's done a version of that on his website at the top. What is that next best step that you want them to take? One of the ways in which people have been studied to read websites is the Z-pass. So they start in the upper left, they move to the right, then they go down to above the fold on the left-hand side. Notice on our website, the two next decision points that we're going to have, the start here and the schedule a meeting, that's my CTA. My goal is to have you schedule a meeting, schedule a triage call, a 25-minute conversation. Now, there's also opportunities for them to learn more about who we serve, who we are, what our process is. But on every single one of those pages, I'm intentional about what I want them to take. What action do I want them to take? I want them to schedule a meeting. They can also subscribe to the newsletter, which feeds into ActiveCampaign, which then gets put into funnels and et cetera. And we can talk more about that if we have questions about that. But the common denominator there is I want them to schedule an appointment and I want to make that as easy as possible knowing that they're in the right place. We talked a little bit about this, no, just using their vernacular, anything that we would add to this, Don?
Yeah, I love how you say call to action. To me, don't overlook that. That is so important. By the time I meet with my Googlers, I kind of talked about this in yesterday's meeting with How to Excel in Limitless. I'm really deliberate with Loom Video. You use Loom Video too, right? Mm-hmm. So I make it a point to keep it 60 seconds or less because my Googlers, they're super busy. So I acknowledge that, hey, 60 seconds of your life. And the idea is this, when I get a referral, it's usually gonna happen this way. I'm gonna get an email from a Googler introducing me to a Googler. Don, meet, you know, such and such will be done. BCC. I send a Loom Video, 60 seconds or less saying, hey, thank you so much for introduction. My only ask is you complete my discovery questionnaire. It takes about 5-10 minutes, certainly take as long as you like, and it can be accessed on any smart device, i.e. Chromebook, Samsung, tablet, you name it. I'm speaking their language because my Googlers, that's the tech they use. 60 seconds, no problem, I can use it on my phone. What's happening? That link is gonna qualify them. I will know right there and then if they meet my numbers. Then the second video, hey, thanks for completing the discovery questionnaire. Here's what I'm gonna go over. I'm gonna do a demo of how I plan. And I will say this in this language. If this resonates with you, if you like the way I plan, choose a date and time and our calendars, should I have come, will sync. We'll sync. By the time we have our first virtual meeting, it's not really our first meeting, it's our third. Why? Because they've seen me 2 times. So the power of influence, if they've already seen me the third time, something about 3, right? And it's my favorite number, John Starks, New York, right? The third time, the meat of the discussion is, hey, Don, great to finally meet you. I don't have any questions other than what's your fee structure like and what's the process going forward? Fantastic. Hard work is done. I already know they meet my numbers. I already know they like my presentation. I've set the expectation. It's just a matter of, are we a good fit for each other? That's how I streamline my work.
So this probably isn't the time that I say I'm a Reggie Miller fan and I enjoy what...
That cuts deep. Indiana, I forgot. That's all right. You didn't get the ring either, so it's okay.
Old NBA history okay. There.
That's all right.
Coming back to Know Your Niche, this little template right here is the template that I used when I was interviewing optometrists, practice owners, the executive director of the Indiana Optometric Association, leaders of the local societies. This is on tribe, or not on tribe, excuse me, in community. If you link, or if you just go in there, search, I believe, Allison, it would be nested under niche or... Okay. Oh, good. I should have known that. Thank you, Allison. It's in your workbooks. These are the questions that I use to best understand the problems that we're facing practice owners. Use this as if you're in that situation of trying to figure out how can I show up and solve my ideal prospects, my niche's problems. This is the format that I use. There's a couple of different tools that you can use out there, but this is the one that worked well for me. The idea here is to figure out how are you going to craft your process and your planning experience around the problems that they have before they even necessarily know that they have their problem, right? This is kind of along what Steve Jobs did with Apple. People weren't asking for the iPhone. Henry Ford, people weren't asking, right? What was his famous line? If I asked the people what they wanted, they'd just say a faster horse. The idea here in giving people our value proposition to our optometry clients is that we know that if let's say that they're already working with an advisor, we say, Dr. Prospect, we understand that if you're contemplating hiring us, you're also gonna have to think about firing them. What I would say to you and submit to you is that the difference between your current advisor and what we do is that what they think of as world-class planning is bare bones and table stakes for us. The difference is that we know what questions and strategies to consider for you that neither you nor your advisory team haven't even thought of considering because we know the business of optometry so well. Does that make sense? And so what I'm doing there is 2 things. Number one, I'm seeding a little bit of doubt. Now, some might criticize that, whatever it might be, but my goal with every prospect, with every relationship that we serve is to have them make the right decision the first time with every dollar that they have. Income is all of our greatest wealth building tools. A lot of us focus on AUM. A lot of us focus on gathering assets and how do I build my AUM book of business? And then you'll inevitably have prospects say, oh, I don't have enough money. I'll come back to you when I'm rich. And like my response is like, okay, so let me know when you win the lottery. Like income is all of our clients and our greatest wealth building tool. So all of the messaging that I have with our optometry clients is, how do we harness the income that your practice, an optometry practice is 2 things. It's a conduit for cash flow and it's an asset on your balance sheet. How do we use the conduit of cash flow to grow net worth outside the practice while at the same time growing this asset so that when there is an eventual exit, you've extracted max value of that asset to ultimately live life on purpose and solve for joy? Is their current advisor saying, now that's my example. I hope that me sharing that can plant some seeds, no pun intended here, I guess, based off what I was doing with our ideal clients. How can you shift your messaging to your prospects to insert the idea that you know something that they don't know or that they haven't thought of and you can proactively plan for things that haven't already happened. To Don's point, hey, have you thought about the stock split coming up? Oh, does that affect, like, proactively and preemptively having those conversations, that is what separates the cream from the milk. That's what makes you different. That's what makes you weird. And that's what you're solving for as advisors in your niche. I think we did things a little bit differently.
No, I think you flew it, man. You're good.
All right. It's good. We'll keep going. But basically the point that I want to make here on these two slides is there's from a bisection or an either or path that you can go down. Some advisors think, oh, I need to burn the ships and I need to fire all of my clients and I only need to work. I need to just kind of start over. I didn't do that. I don't think you did that either. I mean, you had your existing, I mean, there are some advisors that will truly do that. They'll either sell their book of business and truly build it new from the ground up. Aggressive, I will say on the other side of it, it's a lot easier if you choose that path because now you don't have to solve for your generic clients. We, on the other end, did the steady transition where we had our existing clients. We eventually got to the point where we said no to anybody that didn't have OD after their name. And now we say no to anybody that doesn't have OD and business owner as part of who they are. That refined process is going to be something that you're going to have to go through. And again, there's no blanket statement. There's not that you're just going to have to do the math on that. Yes, Christy.
When you were both starting your niche, what was the number of households that you had
like how many niche clients did I have before I knew that I had a niche?
Right.
Two.
Wow.
Two.
Yeah, two. I had two.
Yeah, it brings up so much of that, like, imposter. You know, you're sitting there talking to someone, you're like, I'm the expert, but I have two clients.
Pay no attention to the person behind the curtain, right?
Right, but no, but I mean, I think you have to do, like, it's when I'm, you know, like, when I look at what percentage of ours are ideal, you know, and doing that two in one out, like, it brings up all that head trash.
Ready, fire, aim. I mean, it's a variation of, oh, I'll come see you when I win the lottery. Like, that's never going to happen unless we start somewhere.
No, I think
yeah.
Heard it.
Yeah.
It like
yeah. I mean, I had two.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Garrett.
So, I mean, when you're thinking about this, obviously there's the money side of it, but when you're really thinking about that, right? I
mean, what do you mean by that?
So when you started thinking of your niche, about two people that fit that, was it really something you just like kind of,
Hold on, here. Go ahead. We're going to shift into Q&A a little bit here, so because we're basically at the end anyway.
So for your niche, was it something that you looked at your book and you said, okay, there's two of those? Mm-hmm. Was it something you just kind of said, I really like working with those? And then, you know, like Don said, you know, the money follows passion.
Yeah.
So, I mean, was there anything more than that when you were kind of deciding who to work with and how to do it?
So I didn't say this, but what's funny is I've been working with my niche consistently for 48 months or less than 48 months, you know, 3 years and whatever this is. If you were to take an asset map, my that's my core stack, right? And take a template of the average household of Google that I work with, it is a mirror image of my own personal finances, age, net worth, and everything, and saving habits. That's because, to your point, Garrett, I was really jazzed about saying, hey, what's if you wanted to build $1 million and you had zero, what would it take, right? And if I was sitting in your shoes, knowing your comp, knowing your stock vests, knowing your habits, this is what I would do. When I tell it to the engineer, Don, tell me how much it is, and we will get that to you. When I'm talking to the creatives at YouTube, Don, does that mean I can buy this house and so forth? So I've really aligned my passion for personal investing with the clients I work with. So that's where I experienced that exponential growth, because all I was doing was just doing what I love. And then I just got lost in my work. I wasn't worried about the numbers. When I saw the numbers, I was like, holy cow, I think I'm good at this. So what happens if I take it seriously? Then I hire a VA, I hire a content writer to write all that stuff. So I'm just doing nothing but talking to clients.
One or two. For me, mine evolved. Mine was more so along the lines of, I realized from a financial standpoint, what some of those practices were doing in revenue and in income, and they fit the bill of what an ideal client looked like. And that very, very, very quickly for me evolved in just feeding my own personal urge. I love business. I love working on businesses. I love business more than I love financial planning. Candidly, if I never do a financial plan again, I'd be the happiest advisor in the world. And that's why I have John on the team. I won't really touch e-money anymore. I don't care to. That's not my best value to our clients and to the business. That's why I'm here in Limitless. I love business and I love working on businesses and I love the business of optometry. So that evolved. And that's what kind of fueled that fire for me to now have impact at scale in the field of optometry.
Okay, question from Elliot online. I have many clients that aren't in my niche, but I love helping, are profitable, and want to keep. How do others handle having your public-facing marketing focused on a niche that some clients aren't a part of?
That was the one mistake that I made. Well, I made many, but let me clarify that a little bit more. Let me become a little bit more surgical with that admission of guilt or admission of fault. The mistake that I made in transitioning publicly facing the brand, the website, 2020 Money, I did not effectively communicate with our existing clients the decision that I was making, and it cost me one relationship. A decent relationship is about a $700,000 account, and I found out the way every advisor loves to find out. They get the ACAT notice. Called the client, had the conversation, or former client, and they said, Adam, we've seen what you're doing in the website. We've seen some of the messaging, and they were a retired client, and we just feel like we're not the best fit for you anymore. We wish you all the best, but we found another advisor that works with retirees, and we're going to work with them. After licking my wounds a little bit, my response then was to send out messaging a little bit more proactively to our existing client base. The resounding feedback that I got was, we're really happy for you. We're excited for what you're doing in your business. Just don't forget about us. So to Elliot's point, you can do that. And we had, I think at the time, 70-ish households that we were working with that were non-optometrists, right? We had two that were within my niche. So talk about imposter syndrome, right? Building out this massive website of we help optometrists plan life on purpose. All two of them, right? Yay, right? I know I have the email compliance, right? I'll see if I can find it. In true Adam form, it was probably 5.5 pages long, refined down to 3 after 4 hours of editing. I'm somewhat kidding. I don't remember exactly, but it did convey that message that we're making this shift, we're seeing impact. Honestly, I don't remember, but it was this messaging, just because we're making this shift on the outside looking in, we're not compromising the conditions of how we've shown up and delivered value to you over this time. And our business model for our existing clients is not going to change. And that fed in, as we talked yesterday about the service model that we have in our firm, why we've created the base plus service model, right? The base service model is 2 cornerstone reviews, Surge, right? And that handles not only our existing niche clients, their cornerstone, big picture, 30,000 foot view, plan review, but it also helps us deliver significant value to our non-optometry clients. And then the plus part of that service model are the little micro interactions that we have with our OD practice owners. And we do that via Loom, via other communication, utilizing other pieces of technology. So hopefully sure. Yep.
To that question, I was gonna, I know Virg is waiting patiently. Okay. I thought you answered that question really good. And I forgot the question.
What do you do about non-marketing, like creating that messaging publicly facing and then having your non-niche clients see that outward messaging of we only work with Googlers or what?
Okay.
Yeah.
So my current book of business of Googlers is 45 to 50%. That fluctuation is because of the market. The ones who were grandfathered, the ones before my niche, they see my website and they say, so this is how you help big tech now, huh? I'm like, yeah. And this is the process you're using for us? Yeah, awesome. That's the response. If you go to my website, I literally have my brochure of how I service big tech. Our clients are different, and so are we. And I explain it to the point where even if you're not big tech, you know my process. So my existing clients, because I don't prospect any non-Googlers anymore. So the idea is, wow, so we get your process and we're thrilled that this is what works for Google, because their perception of Google, rightfully so, is they're dynamic, they're leading, and they're, lack of a better word, honored that I'm using the same process to assist them in their financial planning.
One more question.
Bird, did you still have a question? Okay.
A bunch of questions, but I'll go quick. First, I'm a Sixer fan, just for so that you know. Adam, you're charging a onboarding fee, a monthly fee, and an AUM fee.
That's affirmative.
Is that right? Okay. And then, can you rank where you source your leads from?
Yeah.
So just real quick, where as you rank them as far as you know, the most effective to the least effective, where would you say?
It's a three prong or the top. Three places that we get, and we source that in Acuity. When they book an appointment, they have to click how they found us.
Right.
It's, I don't want to say evenly split, but it kind of comes in waves. 2020 money. I'm active and provide advice in a community, a Facebook community called ODs on Finance. And the right, it's basically three or four, depending on the season, the writing that I do for Review of Optometric Business. I've had a standing column there for the better part of 5 years. Or the speaking that I do. I speak at all the national optometry conferences. I get paid to speak. They source me for those presentations. And that's much more of an ebb and flow, right? We'll get a decent number of inquiries after a speaking, and then that trails off.
All right, so the podcast, some writing, some speaking.
Yep.
So all those you're saying are the greatest sources of leads for you. And Don, how'd you get your first Google client?
How did I?
How'd you get your first Google client?
COI 2008.
Hey, Antoine, I appreciate your question to Adam, because you've monetized like three streams of income, right? Podcast and so forth. So if I was sitting here, the FOMO starts happening, right? I'm thinking, oh crap, I gotta do a podcast. I gotta do speaking events and so forth. No. That's where, for me at least, the discipline comes in. No. I wanna focus on surge and niche first so I can really sharpen my axe and just kill it that way. That's how I get my stream of income. So don't feel like if it works for Adam, it unless it really resonates with you, don't feel compelled to do it. Because even though I'm literally like, wow, this Adam is monetizing his life. I'm going to enjoy that FOMO for 5 minutes and then I'll go off to my work.
I'm having the same impact. I'm just doing it differently. Yeah. Yeah. But I surged the podcast. Like I won't record another podcast until the beginning of June.
Garrett.
So you guys both have kind of two in-game strategies too. I know Don's on a 10-year sprint, right? And then Adam, I mean, you just brought on advisor to handle all new clients.
Yeah, he's lead advisor. Yeah.
So is that something that kind of came just from the amount of traction you're getting with niche? Or mm-hmm. is that something that you kind of thought about, okay,
that's
evolved do I want to get out of the business or not?
No, that evolved too. And we've got the flywheel going right now. One of my favorite books is Flywheel. It's the monograph to Good to Great by Jim Collins. And it just talks about identifying six or less strategies or decision points in your business that play off one another. Amazon has a flywheel. Google has a flywheel, right? That's this theory. So the flywheel that I created, the podcast is one of those. And we've got that momentum going. My mission is to have impact at scale, both in the advisory community as well as in the optometry community. So because of that, the forcing mechanism that I, or the fork in the road, do I develop a solicitor's license or create a solicitor's agreement and then refer out all of these ideal prospects that are reaching out to us, wanting to work with us? Or do I scale the business? I've made the decision right now to scale. We're going to be hiring probably two more people this year to help with the growth in the practice. So my point in that's my experience. The only thing that's going to be constant in your business as you evolve this niche is change. Be prepared for that. Be cognizant of that. And just write one of our tenant phrases that we have here in Limitless is, when the vision is clear, the decisions are easy. So make them easy to execute. But my point in that is my vision actually changed. Be prepared for that it can happen. It's okay that it happens. It evolves. But know that that might change your decision.
Know your numbers, and especially through niching, helps me get really clear on my business too. So I'm glad you remember the 10-year sprint. That's like my lingo with my Googlers. I'm super lean in my expenses. I'm a deliberate solo practitioner. I have a VA and I have a content writer, because those are the two things I don't want to do. And the idea is this: everything from here on in, it's all profit, because my expenses are low. I just pay myself reasonable compensation, keep the IRS away from me, and everything else is great. If I hit my stride, 6 to 8 clients per year, fantastic. If I don't, I'll live. I'm good, because I'm still meeting with my Googlers, and that's the stuff I enjoy. And I challenge my peers to really make it a point to align what you love doing with your niche. Because when you do that, that's in my opinion, when you'll really experience and feel, keyword feel, exponential growth. Because my second year, I had the same experience, right? My revenue off the charts, but I felt burnt out because I wasn't in the right mindset.
What's the end of the 10 year?
I wanted to get out of the game when I'm 50. I'm 42 now. And I figured based on my saving habits, like my Googlers, I have a magic number based on how much I save on my average rate of return, and I can walk away from the game.
Carl Richards would tell you that's wrong.
Yeah, because now I'm going to be bored. My wife's going to say, what are you going to do? I'm going to own a mom and pop comic shop.